From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I heard a loud noise like a bomb blast, and after that, luggage and everything fell on me, and everyone started running. It was a chaotic situation.
At least 7 explosions ripped through packed commuter trains in Mumbai, killing more than 180 people and injuring over 700. No one's claimed responsibility. We'll go to Mumbai to get an eyewitness report. Then investigative reporter Greg Pallast reports on the disputed presidential election in Mexico.
I booked the first flight out to Mexico City to answer the question, did Felipe Calderon of the conservative PAN, the party in power, win the presidential election fairly, or was this just another Florida con salsa?
And the widow of Al Jazeera reporter Tarek Ayub is bringing a lawsuit against the Bush administration for her husband's death. He was killed April 8, 2003, when the U.S. military bombed the Al Jazeera offices in Baghdad. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Police in India are hunting for clues as to who is behind Tuesday's deadly bomb attacks on Mumbai's train network that killed at least 183 people and injured over 700. The near simultaneous blasts happened at the height of the evening rush hour. 7 explosions ripped through commuter trains and stations within 15 minutes of each other. The blasts all happened in fast trains and inside first-class carriages. Train cars were blown apart. Witnesses reported body parts littering the railway tracks. Television images showed footage of bystanders carrying victims in the rain to ambulances and searching through the wreckage for survivors and bodies. An eyewitness described the scene.
I heard a loud noise like a bomb blast, and after that, luggage and everything fell on me, and everyone started running. It was a chaotic situation. Due to the blast, the trains are not running and people are stuck inside the trains and can't get home.
Hundreds of thousands of people were stranded overnight after the train shut down. An 8th bomb was reportedly defused in Mumbai suburban station. The attacks are the worst in Mumbai for more than a decade. We'll have more on the India bomb attacks after headlines. Israel's threatening a heavy response following the capture of 2 Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah along the Lebanon-Israel border. Hezbollah is demanding the release of all Lebanese prisoners inside Israel. The soldiers were seized after Hezbollah launched rocket attacks at Israeli border posts in a nearby town. 4 Israeli civilians were wounded. A reported 2 Lebanese civilians were killed when Israel bombed 3 bridges in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah is demanding the release of all Lebanese prisoners in Israel. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting IDF officials are warning Lebanon's clock will be turned back 20 years unless the soldiers are returned. Meanwhile, the Palestinian death toll from Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip continues to rise by the day. Earlier today, 7 people were killed when an Israeli strike destroyed a 3-story building in Gaza. The dead included a mother and 3 children. At least 24 people were wounded in the attack, among them top Hamas commander Mohammed Deif. Israel says it was targeting a meeting of Hamas activists who had taken part in the capture of the soldier Gilad Shalit. Witnesses said additional victims might still be buried beneath the rubble. Another 3 Palestinians, 2 militants, and a police officer were also killed today. Meanwhile, thousands of people gathered for a funeral procession for recent victims of Israeli attacks, including a 1-year-old girl who died last week. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh repeated Hamas's call for a negotiated prisoner swap with Israel.
We and the Palestinian government are still committed to the initiative we have made, and we say that political negotiations, diplomacy, and calm are the way out of the current crisis.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the U.S. continues to block a Security Council resolution demanding Israel's immediate withdrawal from Gaza and emergency aid to the Palestinians. The resolution also calls for the release of the Israeli soldier and an end to all rocket attacks on Israeli towns. U.S. Ambassador John Bolton said, quote, "Our position remains the same. We don't see at this point any utility in council action at all." In Iraq, at least 50 people have killed and been killed in the violence in Baghdad. Earlier today, 7 people were killed and 20 wounded in a suicide attack in a restaurant. Other deaths were reported in a double suicide bombing near the U.S.-run Green Zone and an attack on a bus of Shiite mourners returning from a funeral. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is in Iraq on an unannounced visit. Speaking to reporters en route from another surprise stop in Afghanistan, Rumsfeld said the Iraqi government is not ready to decide on a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. He also rejected Iraqi calls for revoking the immunity granted to U.S. forces in Iraq. His comments come one day after Iraq's human rights minister said he'll bring the request to revoke U.S. immunity to the United Nations. In other Iraq news, The Washington Post is reporting the Pentagon's discontinuing its multi-billion-dollar logistics contract with Halliburton. The decision will affect most of Halliburton's operations in Iraq. The company has come under intense scrutiny for its close ties to the Bush administration and a series of well-publicized accusations of incompetence, corruption, and fraud. Government audits of Halliburton's Iraq services have found more than $1 billion in questionable costs. No company has been awarded more money in contracts from the Iraq war. Halliburton pulled in over $7 billion last year and is expected to make at least $4 billion this year. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee opened hearings Tuesday on legal rights of Guantanamo prisoners. This is Committee Chair Arlen Specter.
And we are now proceeding to follow the requirements of constitutional and international law as handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States, and to do it in a way which will permit us to fairly try those accused of war crimes.
The hearings come as a response to last month's Supreme Court ruling against the Bush administration's forming of military tribunals to try prisoners at Guantanamo. The court said the tribunals violate both the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Convention. The court ruled Geneva Convention must apply to prisoners captured in the War on Terror. The hearings come one day after the Pentagon announced it would grant prisoners minimal rights granted under the Geneva Conventions. White House legal adviser Stephen Bradbury defended the White House position.
The administration will, of course, as the president has said, abide by the decision of the court. It is important to point out, however, that the court did not question the authority of the United States to detain enemy combatants in the War on Terror, and its decision does not require us to close Gitmo or release any terrorist. The court implicitly recognized that the vicious attacks of al-Qaeda triggered our right to use military force in self-defense, and that we are involved in an armed conflict with al-Qaeda.
Meanwhile, Senator Patrick Leahy criticized the Bush administration's conduct in the so-called War on Terror.
For 5 years, the administration has violated fundamental American values, damaged our international reputation, and delayed and weakened prosecution of the War on Terror. Not because of any coherent strategic view that it had, but because of its stubborn unilateralism and dangerous theory of unfettered executive power augmented by self-serving legal reasoning. Guantanamo Bay has been such a debacle that even the president now says it should be shut down.
The Judiciary Committee is one of at least 3 congressional panels taking up the issue. The Senate Armed Services Committee will hold a hearing Thursday. In this news on the CIA leak case, columnist Robert Novak has revealed White House aide Karl Rove was a confirming source in his story outing the CIA operative Valerie Plame. Novak did not reveal who first told him of Valerie Plame's identity. In health news, the Senate voted Tuesday to ban the seizure of prescription drugs that Americans bring in from Canada. Thousands of people have turned to Canadian pharmacies to seek out cheaper alternatives to U.S. medications. Both chambers of Congress must agree on a final version before the measure becomes law. The Bush administration and leading Republicans have opposed the effort. They argue imported Canadian drugs could be harmful and could be used to hide dangerous chemicals for terror attacks. Critics say the Bush administration is trying to protect drug industry profits. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is reporting the elderly will see another double-digit rise in their Medicare premiums next year. Monthly payments are expected to reach nearly $100. The payments could go even higher unless Congress acts to cut physician fees, but it's not expected to do so. The White House has released data showing top staffers have received a raise of more than $4,000 this year. The staffers include Chief Strategist Karl Rove, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, and Counselor Dan Bartlett. The news comes on the same day House Republicans voted for the fifth time in 2 weeks against considering a proposal to raise the minimum wage. The Bush administration is also opposing the minimum wage increase. And in Wisconsin, a 29-year-old man was killed Sunday when police officers shocked him with a taser gun. According to his family, the victim, Nicholas Sears, has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was diagnosed 10 years ago. The killing occurred after police found him trespassing in a home under construction. They hit him with two shots when he ignored orders to put his hands behind his back to be handcuffed. Sears' family is outraged. His parents had reported their son missing the night before and say police were aware of his condition. According to Amnesty International, 150 people have been killed by tasers since 2001. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Police in India are hunting for clues as to who is behind Tuesday's deadly bomb attacks on Mumbai's train system, which killed over 180 people and injured over 700. Mumbai, formerly known as Bombay, is India's financial capital, and the near simultaneous blasts happen at the height of the evening rush hour. At least seven explosions ripped through commuter trains and stations within 15 minutes of each other. The blasts all happened in fast trains and inside first-class cars. The city's train system is one of the busiest in the world, carrying more than 6 million commuters a day. Train cars were blown apart. Witnesses reported body parts littering railway tracks. Television images showed footage of bystanders carrying victims in the rain to ambulances and searching through the wreckage for survivors and bodies. In the immediate aftermath of the blast, the city's entire rail network was shut down, stranding hundreds of thousands of people in Mumbai overnight. Another bomb was reportedly defused in a suburban station. Police have carried out a series of raids across Maharashtra, the state in which Mumbai lies. The attacks are the worst in the city for more than a decade. More than 250 people died in a string of blasts in the city in 1993. No one has claimed responsibility for the attacks. The Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, urged calm and blamed unnamed terrorists. But security sources in India have said the synchronized bombings were likely to have been carried out by militants connected to one or more of the dozens of armed Kashmiri separatist groups. Two of the main Muslim militant groups operating Kashmir today denied any involvement. We go now to Mumbai to speak with Natasha Natu, a journalist with the Times of India. She was on the scene at one of the blasts yesterday. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yeah, hi.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what you saw yesterday?
Yeah, see, the moment we reached there, this is a suburb called Borivali, which is, which is at the, it's at the fringe of the city. This is where the city ends. And when we reached there almost an hour after the blast actually happened. There were still a lot of witnesses, a lot of coolies, that's water boys and shoeshine boys, and basically the people who helped accident victims out, who took them to the hospital, who actually pulled out mangled bodies from the compartment. And we spoke to them, and the way they described the scene was, the sound was deafening. I mean, it was something that they'd never heard before. They thought it was something like hundreds of gas cylinders exploding at the same time, something of that sort. And all they could see were body pieces, because Mumbai trains are packed to the capacity. You have a lot of commuters hanging on the doors, something which you wouldn't really see in some other city probably. So after the blast, there were a lot of these people who fell right onto the tracks, and some of them got killed right there. So these shoeshine boys and porters, who were the first one to reach the spot, actually pulled out those people, and lots of, I mean, they couldn't really see a lot of bodies. There were just hands and severed heads and limbs, and there were women in adjoining compartments, so a lot of them were like really, really panicked, and they didn't know what to do. But a lot of passengers who had minor injuries also joined in to help the accident victims and to remove the dead body. And in almost like say an hour later, they were all moved to the neighboring hospital.
The blasts in Mumbai came hours after suspected Islamic militants killed eight people, seven of them tourists, in five grenade attacks in Srinagar in Kashmir. Is there any relation?
probably the government, the authorities here are still trying to establish if there's any relation. They are questioning people and eyewitnesses, especially in Bombay. They have been questioning and taking down statements from a lot of eyewitnesses here. People, some of them describe having seen two men, in a suspicious manner, moving about in a suspicious manner yesterday. So they've been questioning a lot of people, trying to establish a relationship, if there's any, between the two.
The Pakistani president, General Musharraf, has condemned the bombings. What is the significance of this?
Well, it does make a difference, because here, especially, a lot of people are under the impression that it could be the handiwork of a communal outfit. So there have been instances yesterday where a lot of Muslim men and women also came to help out victims, Hindu victims. So in that sense, it does make a difference, because after what happened, after what the city saw last week, there was, it was many people were under the impression that it's probably a communal related blast or something to do with communal sentiments. So in that sense, it does make a lot of difference.
Explain further what happened last week.
Last week, there's a suburb called Bhiwandi, which is outside Bombay. And there was a land dispute there between the government, a piece of land owned by the government, and the local people. The people claimed that the land was for a Muslim cemetery, a graveyard. And the government claimed it was its land, so it could build a police station there. So there were riots there in which four people were killed, two civilians, following which the local residents attacked the police and killed two policemen, lynched them alive. So after that, the city has been under tension. Probably a lot of people have been thinking that, yesterday's blast could probably be related to last week's incident at Bhiwandi.
We're talking to Natasha Natu, a reporter with the Times of India. She was on the scene at one of the blasts yesterday. She is in Mumbai. Can you go back to 1993 and talk about what happened then, and then about tensions in the community in Mumbai?
Yeah, there's been a lot of tension, as I told you before. People have probably been under the impression that it's something to do with communal forces, because back in 93, the riots in 93 were very communal, or because of the blast that took place in 93, the outfits that claimed responsibility for them and the riots that followed were very communal. So even yesterday's blast, people thought were probably on the same lines, were very communal. But I don't think it's going to be that bad this time, because this time around we've had a lot of NGOs, a lot of common people coming up from across the city, poor people, slum dwellers, people from everywhere who've put behind their religious differences and who've come to help people affected in the blast. This is very rare, like people coming from across religions, especially there's been a lot of Hindu-Muslim tension. But despite that, you had you had Muslim men coming and helping Hindu men who were affected in the blast, putting all kinds of differences behind them. In that sense, I think it's quite a difference now from the 93 blast. That time it was very communal. This time it's not.
India is home to the second largest Muslim population in the world, around 150 million people, yet still a minority in India. Can you talk about the government and its relation to Muslims, the Indian government?
Well, the Indian government, its relation to Muslims, the government has not really made any kind, it's not really biased or in any way, biased to the Muslims or to the Hindus or any such. There's no difference in the attitude or something. I guess in everyday life there are instances where these little differences keep cropping up, and when something like this happens, like a blast happens, it tends to,
And is there fear? Is there fear of more bomb attacks?
Yesterday there was, yes. There were 3 to 4 calls that the police got, anonymous calls. People kept saying, we found a bag here. And, there's probably a fear of a bomb hoax in some other suburb. And today, again, the police control rooms have been buzzing with, hoax callers who keep saying that they suspect a bomb blast at some part of the suburb. People keep finding bags unidentified bags or lunch boxes and stuff like that. But there have been a lot of rumors, yes. So in that sense, there has been a fear of another bomb attack. But there's nothing really been.
Natasha Natu, I want to thank you very much for being with us, reporter with the Times of India, speaking to us from Mumbai. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we turn to the disputed Mexican presidential elections. Stay with us. Earth and Sky by Sharab here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the Mexican presidential elections, last week election authorities announced that conservative candidate Felipe Calderón, a former energy minister, had defeated Andrés Manuel López Obrador by a razor-slim margin. This was after electoral officials recounted ballot tallies from the initial vote. The recount showed Calderón won the presidency by the closest margin in Mexico's history, around 220,000 votes of 41 million cast, or just over half a percentage point. But López Obrador has refused to concede, citing electoral fraud. On Sunday, López Obrador and his supporters filed a request for a full vote-by-vote recount of the election. They've also called for supporters to begin marching on the Capitol today and to join up for a huge march in Mexico City on Sunday. Yesterday, he released a preliminary video of what it says proves, of what he says proves that he was cheated out of last week's presidential election. In a video shot in the central state of Guanajuato, the footage shows an apparent supporter of Calderón's National Action Party, the PAN, stuffing a ballot box on the day of the elections. Mexico's Federal Electoral Court will review the case, which includes videos, campaign propaganda, and electoral documents. The court has until September 6th to actually declare a winner. Meanwhile, yesterday, Felipe Calderón announced his plans for a victory tour through Mexico. Investigative reporter Greg Pallast was in Mexico City to cover the story. He filed this report.
July 3rd. I was in my office in London when the phone rang. It was Mexico City. I was told, take a look at the Mexican papers. The exit polls in the presidential election there showed a clear win for Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the left-wing's candidate for president. But the official count gave the election to George Bush's ally, Felipe Calderón, of the right-wing ruling party, the PAN. Exit polls that don't match the official vote count. I'd heard that story before. In Ohio in 2004, John Kerry led Bush in the exit polls, and in 2000, Al Gore won in the Florida exit polls. But in both cases, George Bush won in the official count. So I booked the first flight out to Mexico City to answer the question, did Felipe Calderón of the conservative PAN, the party in power, win the presidential election fairly, or was this just another Florida con salsa? The official numbers just didn't add up. So my first stop was to meet one of Mexico's top numbers experts, statistician Victor Romero of Mexico's National University. Dr. Romero had charted the official government elections returns from each of Mexico's 113,000 voting stations.
The way I did this was a friend of mine that he had the result second by second.
And randomly, this can't happen.
Can't happen.
So what did happen then?
There's a miracle here. How did the miracle occur?
I don't know.
On a computer printout, Dr. Romero showed how the official tallies matched the exit polls, with challenger Lopez Obrador ahead by 2% all night, that is, until the very end, when several precincts came in for the ruling party by 10-1, and then 100-1, putting their candidate Felipe Calderon over the top, literally in the last minutes. The doctor found that statistically improbable.
With this 3 point, I said it's over. But then, from 71% till the very end, there was not a single moment in which the difference from one report to the next became bigger. It was always...
So it didn't change at all, it just was perfect.
Perfect, perfect. And so we just couldn't believe it. No? I mean, it fell with 5% to go. It fell one full point.
So then what happened?
Another miracle. Statistically, it's a second miracle. But now, it is...
Well, are you a religious man?
I'm not a religious man.
So you don't believe in miracles?
No, but other people do, so, you know. They say that it works even if you don't believe in them, so...
Okay.
The results may not seem so miraculous. If you take a look at these voter sheets, this is from a district in Guanajuato, which shows that Calderon picked up 192 votes, but Obrador, the challenger, got only 12. And here's how this miraculous total can be explained. We were given a videotape of a poll worker seen here stuffing ballots into the unguarded cardboard ballot box. Mexico has virtually zero ballot security in rural areas. There is no system for accounting for unused paper ballots. Stuffing them into the cardboard boxes is absurdly easy. Despite the evidence of ballot stuffing, the conflict with exit polls, and the miraculous returns, the Federal Election Commission in Mexico named Calderon the winner by a margin thin as a tortilla, by less than one half of 1%. The rush to announce a winner was all the more surprising, given the wave of other reported irregularities. This is Cesar Yanez, who directed the campaign for López Obrador's party, the PRD. He noted there were 300,000 fewer votes for president than for senator, a drop-off that voting experts say never happens without fraud. Yanez guessed maybe they ate their votes. The Federal Election Commission's rush to announce a winner caught my attention because of the astonishingly high pile of supposedly uncountable votes, nearly 1 million blank, unreadable ballots, four times the alleged margin of victory. The smell of Florida was unmistakable. In the 2000 U.S. election, Florida Secretary of State Catherine Harris stopped a hand count of 179,000 supposedly blank ballots. Mexico's Electoral Commission, taking the exact same stance as Harris, is refusing to have a public hand count of those supposedly blank 1 million ballots. Yanez noted that the commission agreed to open a fragment of 1% of the ballot packets. In most cases, ballots that were totaled as blank were in fact votes for Obrador.
En la mayoría de esos paquetes electorales se encontraron votos a favor de Andrés Manuel, votos que eran considerados nulos.
Each box open produced enough newfound votes for Obrador that opening all the boxes should statistically change the outcome of the election. But all the boxes won't be opened. The ruling party, the PAN, and the Electoral Commission refuse a full public recount. And the government says that it's over.
Felipe Calderon and his ally George Bush say it's all over. But there are hundreds of thousands of people here who say not until all the votes are counted, one by one.
On Saturday, 500,000 Obrador supporters filled the Capitol to make one simple demand. Voto por voto. Count every vote.
We've come here to the ruling party's compound to ask Felipe Calderon exactly why he doesn't want to count all the votes. Mr. Calderon, why not count all the ballots? It would be a question from England.
Calderon gave me the brush off, but the man tipped to be his foreign minister, Arturo Saro Khan, defended his man.
There is a process called the rule of law in this country, and it is not to be used willy-nilly to bend depending on whether you fancy the results of an election or you don't fancy the results of an election. What we have said is that we are convinced that what was not obtained through the ballot box should not be obtained through the streets.
But in Washington, President Bush was too impatient for the full vote count. While the European Union was waiting for a full legal review, Bush called Calderon to congratulate him on his victory. And evidence suggests that George Bush may have secretly tried to help in that victory. We have obtained from U.S. FBI files a copy of a secret government contract with a private firm, Choice Point, of Alpharetta, Georgia. Choice Point, you may recall, is the company that provided a list to Catherine Harris in 2000, which permitted her office to wrongly scrub thousands of African Americans from Florida voter rolls. Choice Point, this document indicates, was back in the vote list business in Mexico at the request of the Bush administration. While the cover of their September 2001 contract says it is to gather intelligence for counterterrorism investigations, the still classified appendix, which we have, clarifies that the contract is limited to gathering citizen files and voter lists of Latin American nations, specifically those nations which have leftist presidents or leading leftist candidates for president. The company, we've learned, did in fact obtain the voter files of Venezuela and Mexico for the FBI. It's difficult to imagine how these files will help in the war on terror, but they can be very useful in influencing Latin American elections. And indeed, we filmed voters in Mexico who found themselves mysteriously scrubbed from voter rolls.
I wasn't able to vote. I wasn't on the list. I waited 7 hours here for nothing. 7 hours in the rain, 7 hours hungry, just so the electoral representatives could laugh at me. The Electoral Commission is a real fraud. I tell you that as a Mexican.
In Mexico City, I met with an Obrador supporter who discovered that, in fact, the ruling party, the PAN, had somehow got a hold of the voter files. She discovered this information after she obtained the secret passwords to the party's website from a whistleblower. We were not allowed to film her face.
I can't tell you how they were using this information, but I can assure you this is illegal. This is a crime.
Are you aware of the fact that a contractor for George Bush and the U.S. FBI obtained all these citizen files?
Yes, Choice Point was the name of the company who got that. Yes, we were aware of that.
But we don't know where this information comes from.
We know that it's in the page, the official page of the candidate.
But they're not supposed to have these for these
people. No. They're not supposed to have it, and of course, they're by no way supposed to use it. That's a crime.
But it could be very helpful.
Well, much more than we ever thought.
She showed me on a computer how to get into the hidden pages of the PAN's website.
This was Calderon's page, right? If you go into the user, Ildebrando117, and you typed in the password, you could type your name, any name. You could find all her information, where she lives, where she's staying, all everything. These are the electoral rolls.
Our source believes that the vote counting software was key to the election victory. She showed us proof that the candidate's brother-in-law was paid to write the vote counting software.
Was the election stolen?
Yes, we can be sure of that. The election was definitely stolen. And people should be there counting the votes, one by one. Democracy doesn't have a time limit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your time. We promise not to show your face.
Thank you.
Why would the Bush administration be so concerned about the presidency of Mexico? There are many issues, but one stands out. It's the oil.
We have to fight to defend our oil so they don't take it to another country. López Obrador is going to fight for what we haven't been able to fight for. We have to save our oil. The oil is ours. It belongs to Mexicans.
Mexico sells more oil to the USA than Saudi Arabia. Leftist López Obrador has stood steadfast against allowing U.S. oil companies to own any part of the Mexican oil system. The PAN, however, has suggested allowing the U.S. oil majors to have a stake in the Mexican oil operations.
We want a country where people aren't persecuted for being rich. People who work have the right to live well, and people who don't work, too bad, tough luck.
This week, I hung around Mexico City, waiting for the inevitable concession speech from Obrador. In the face of ruling party intransigence over recounting the votes, he had no choice but to follow the path of Al Gore and John Kerry, concede defeat. While killing time in a dive with some loud mariachis, I ran into filmmaker Luis Mandoki, Obrador's film biographer. Over chicken mole, he told me that Obrador was of a different character than his U.S. counterparts.
The difference between AMLO and Gore or Kerry is the people. He said, if I wanted, I could stop the country tomorrow. I can. I can block airports, communications, highways. I'm never going to do that. That's not good for the people. He's somebody who's very prudent, very careful. But at the same time, he said, but I'm not going to let him get it because I won the election. I mean, neither Gore nor Kerry had that connection with the country, which he does. And that's where his strength comes from.
He invited me to meet with Obrador the next day. When Mandoki introduced me to the candidate, I asked the upbeat Obrador what he would do if the ruling party simply refused to count the votes.
If they refuse to count the vote, what are you going to do?
Espera, he said. Wait for my answer. It came later that day, before thousands of his chanting supporters.
Vamos a pedir que se cuenten todos los votos.
He's saying, we won't give up, we won't concede. The election's a fraud, and we'll fight in the courts and in the streets, peacefully. And he called for his supporters to march from each of the 300 voting districts to the Capitol beginning Wednesday. 2 million are expected to arrive in Mexico City this weekend to demand a recount. They say it's not over. The fat lady hasn't sung. Not until all ballots are counted. Vote by vote.
Casilla por casilla. Voto por voto. Casilla por casilla. Voto por voto.
That report filed by investigative reporter Greg Pallast from Mexico City. Special thanks to Rick Rowley and Jackie Suhin of Big Noise Tactical Films. Greg Pallast flew in from Mexico City last night and joins us today in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Amy.
Very interesting report. It certainly isn't over. Now, today, a major protest?
Yeah, what's exciting here is that you've got a guy who's really the un-Gore, that is Lopez Obrador, sometimes known as AMLO by his initials. This guy is not conceding, and it's not over with at all. In fact, the only person I know that's said that it's over with is George Bush and his spokesman, Tony Snow, who said the Electoral Commission has chosen a winner. They have not. Even Calderon is not so bold as to say it's over. Lopez Obrador is calling today for people to march from each of the 300 Mexican voting districts from around the country to the Capitol. There were 500,000 people in the Capitol, as we showed in the film, on Saturday. So a couple million people are expected to arrive in the Capitol Saturday. This is going to continue on until at least the end of August because they are demanding a recount of every single vote. Now, it's a simple paper ballot, which you can easily open up and look at. One of the big issues is that there's nearly 1,904,000 votes that are supposedly blank. Just like that's very almost identical to the hanging Chad situation of Florida in 2000, where the Democrats are saying, well, count the votes. AMLO is not doing the Gore thing of saying count a few votes. He's saying count every single vote. Let's open them up. Let's look. It's very, very easy to understand these paper ballots. Why are there a million ballots missing? Why are ballots being stuffed? There's really no ballot security there. Now today, Calderon, last night, Calderon has said yes, he would agree to some selective recounting. But there's a very good chance this election will be annulled.
the first paragraph in the Washington Post today. Felipe Calderon, the free trade booster who was declared the winner of Mexico's disputed presidential election, said Tuesday he would accept a partial recount, but that a complete recount would be absurd and illegal.
Right. What he's hanging on is a rule that there's no particular rule which says that you have to recount every vote. Well, what's unusual, they have the really excellent condition for the voting process in that it's all paper ballots, very easy to recount, but the ruling party is saying don't recount. And you have to, when we say don't recount, you have to understand the counts in the first place are done in these remote areas, 130,000 polling stations, some of which don't have any observers from AMLO's party at all. Tens of thousands, and the results are coming in ridiculous, 100-1 against AMLO. These were precincts that came at the very last minute and put him over the top. So the question is, are we going to recount those every one of the precincts? That's the only way that they're going to get a fair vote. But one of the interesting things is that no one in Mexico believes that this is over with at all. There's a very, very good chance that the election not only may be switched as to who's declared winner, but there's a good chance that the elections tribunal, which has not ruled yet, that's a different group than the elections commission. The elections tribunal will decide by August whether, in fact, the election has to be annulled and a new election held. There's a lot of talk among political leaders there quietly that annulment of the election is a strong possibility.
You were at the news conference that AMLO, the initials, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, held, where he showed the videotape, which he said showed a PAN supporter stuffing a ballot box.
Right. Well, what I did is, as we showed in the film, I actually went out and got the sheets. I wanted to make sure that AMLO wasn't putting one over on us by having one of his own guys stuff a ballot box. And we got the sheets, and it was pretty clear that it was stuffed. But that's one precinct out of 130,000. The point of that was, if you look at just the ballots left around, if you don't vote for president, or there's these empty ballot sheets which anyone could just grab and stuff into a box. There is zero ballot security at all in Mexico. It's just astonishing. So even if you do count, it's not to say that the count will be fair, but at least there is some chance of finding out what's in those packets. And every time they've opened up to me, because I've been covering elections, shoplifting for years. To me, what was interesting was that they have opened up 240 ballot boxes out of the 100-something thousand. And each of those 240 has shown additional votes for AMLO. If he just gets two more votes per polling station, it's over. There's a, then he becomes president.
Speaking of becoming president, President Bush called Calderon. He was one of a handful of foreign leaders who called Calderon to congratulate him. López Obrador is condemning those who would speak out now and before the Electoral Commission.
Well, I think it even embarrassed. Frankly, I think it even embarrassed Calderon himself, the ruling party's candidate, because it made it look like Uncle Sam was petting their little cousin and trying to influence the decision on the outcome. Calderon is a bit wary of saying, "I have absolutely won, it's over with." And it was quite embarrassing for Bush to be congratulating him on it. It's like as if, as if the Mexican president had called up Al Gore the day after the Florida vote and congratulated him. It's not over with by any means. And it was quite embarrassing. In addition, for Calderon, in fact, to make it look like he wasn't George Bush's puppet and Bush wasn't influencing the election, Calderon actually took a big shot at Bush and said, tear down that wall, build no walls. So he's trying to create some distance between himself and Bush. It was very embarrassing for the White House to be stepping in. And as you saw from the film, from our report, we were able to find out the White House looked to be trying to influence the election by grabbing the voter rolls, which, by the way, unlike the United States, the voter rolls in Mexico are private and secret because they also contain all kinds of personal information about each voter. And so they're actually confidential. And we did find out that the ruling party, the PAN, had obtained the private voter rolls and used them for campaigning, which is against the law. And we did ask them about this. They were very embarrassed, and they couldn't give us a good explanation about why it was they suddenly had all the voting rolls and had polling information next to each voter. That's against the law in Mexico. Now, whether they use George Bush's list or not, obviously they have their own routes to get those voter lists. But it's astonishing the lengths that this administration would go to interject itself into the Mexican election. In fact, it's obvious attempts at intervention and very ham-handed have completely embarrassed Calderon to the point where the ruling party actually attempted to arrest Choice Point, the U.S. government contractor, which grabbed the voter rolls, and they put out warrants for company agents' arrests. The company itself now has apologized to the Mexican government.
On a different issue, and speaking of President Bush, as we wrap up, Greg, and we'll certainly continue to follow what's happening in Mexico. In the last few weeks since we spoke to you last, Dan Rather has left CBS. In your book, Armed Madhouse, you talk a lot about Dan Rather, and Dan Rather taking on President Bush. As he was leaving, all of the reports around the country were about how he had fell for a kind of scam, false information about President Bush when he, around the whole story of his military records and serving in the Guard. Can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, we ran the original story on BBC television. I was a reporter showing that George Bush's father, George Sr., used his influence directly to get his son out of the war in Vietnam and into the Texas Air Guard. Rather repeated the story and added a little side story about a memo, which has nothing to do with the main story, about whether basically George Bush's family used influence to get him out of the war. We have never at BBC, unlike Dan Rather, I mean, obviously I haven't resigned, BBC has never retracted a comma of our story at all. The problem for Dan Rather is that he wanted it both ways. I mean, he wanted to do this tough report, but then not stand by it. CBS retracted completely the report about the Bush family using its influence. That was completely wrong of them to do. And to me, it looks as if what CBS was doing was making an example of Rather for putting out a tough report.
And the general story went, it had been proven that he had false documents, and yet the investigative report done by Dick Thornburgh and others actually never took on the issue of documents, and if they were false, why did the White House not prosecute? Because this is falsifying federal
documents. There's absolutely no grounds whatsoever. Supposedly this document, the accusation, the whisper, it's more of a whisper and a rumor than a blank accusation, is that a lieutenant colonel of the Air Guard, Bill Burkett, falsified a document used by Dan Rather. I know Bill Burkett, I've taken a look at this. There is no grounds whatsoever to believe that the document was falsified. The story in chief stands. Neither Burkett nor anyone else can verify whether this little document.
Right, they're not verifying.
It's true. We can't verify this thing at all. I mean, what it is a little sideshow distraction that was used to beat Dan Rather and to punish a reporter for trying to take on the President of the United States. That's what it's all about. It's about punishing reporters and making an example of Rather. Believe me, they know that Greg Palast, frankly, is in exile reporting from England. They know that Dan Rather's carcass of his career has been thrown out on the tarmac. There is no reporter in the United States who's ever going to touch that story or any other story which reflects on the Bush family's extraordinary power.
It's just been announced that Dan Rather has signed a deal to host a show on HDNet. Well, Greg Palast, I want to thank you for being with us. Greg Palast, well known for exposing the 2000 election, first for the BBC, then eventually got into U.S. papers
and
after.
For Democracy Now.
And thank you so much for reporting for Democracy Now! In Mexico City. Greg Palast's latest book is Our Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of a Class War. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Lloro, callo, grito, porque no me quieres. Si yo, esta tierra fue porque había escuchado la promesa que aquí yo encontraría la manera para poder vivir mejor.
Siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito porque no me entienden. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito porque no me entienden.
No quiero que entienda que a mí también corre el sudor, que yo quiero a mi tierra, que a mí también me duele lo mismo que a usted. De aquí como lo es cualquiera, que también me da pena las injusticias, la pobreza de mí.
Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito porque no me entienden. Sufro,
Mi Gente by Ozamatli, featuring the Cumbia Kings, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The widow of Al Jazeera correspondent Tarek Ayoub is bringing a lawsuit against the Bush administration for her husband's death. On April 8, 2003, Tarek Ayoub was reporting from Al Jazeera's offices in Baghdad when he was killed by a U.S. missile. He was the first journalist to be killed in Iraq just hours before U.S. forces seized Baghdad and pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square. Yesterday, the attorney for Dima Tabu, Tarek Ayoub's widow, held a news conference in Washington, D.C., announcing the lawsuit. The attorney, Hamdi Rafai, said the case is being launched in part because of the disclosure last year in London's Daily Mirror that President Bush told British Prime Minister Tony Blair of his desire to bomb Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar. The Mirror cited a secret memo leaked from the British government. We're joined on the phone from Manchester, England, by Dima Tabu. The widow of Tarek Ayoub. We're also joined in studio by Hamdi Rafai, the attorney for Dima. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you explain the lawsuit that you're about to file?
Well, it's become clear over time that, in fact, what occurred in 2003 was not an accident, but may have been something that was intended. And so the reason that we've now filed this lawsuit is because of the revelation of that meeting between Bush and Blair, where in fact it was part of Bush's plans to actually bomb Al Jazeera to keep them from reporting on what was occurring there.
What makes you think it was part of a plan?
Well, you see the facts of it are very different from other incidents. There's been no investigation. We've also seen very contradictory statements from generals in the military. One that said this, one that said that. We've also seen, I'm not going to call it a cover-up, but an attempt to prevent disclosure of what's really happened. So, for example, this meeting between Bush and Blair. Well, there was nothing particularly secretive about it until it became known to the public that there was this meeting and that Bush had made these statements that, well, why don't we bomb Al Jazeera? Interestingly enough, it didn't occur on just this one occasion. It's occurred on many occasions. So when you look at these facts all together, you can't help but reach the conclusion that this was not just an accident. This wasn't a smart bomb that went off 3 miles in the wrong direction.
Dima Tabub, we welcome you back to Democracy Now! We spoke to you soon after your husband was killed. It is now 3 years later. Why have you decided to bring this lawsuit now?
Well, a lot has occurred since, and this lawsuit is a culmination of the efforts we've been taking all through these 3 years. With the disclosure of, as Hamdi was saying, with the disclosure of this memo, now we think that it has not been an accident, and we've thought this all through. We think that it was premeditated because also it was followed by bombing of two offices with the same nature, accommodating people who are working in the press and media. So this is, this is not the first step which we've taken, but it has now taken much force with that, memo being disclosed and revealed that such a discussion occurred between Bush and Blair. And we think that our case now has more strength and more value.
Now, how are you ever going to get a hold of this memo? The British government threatened to use the Official Secrets Act to sue newspapers that publish contents of the leaked memo in which Bush allegedly discussed the bombing of the Arabic satellite network Al Jazeera.
Well, I'm not very familiar with the legal process, but I think that if you know the case has to have any credibility, such a memo has to be disclosed before a court in order, you know, to prove our case that we have grounds and this such a discussion and the action itself was, you know, premeditated, and I think that part of it, you know, is disclosing that memo.
I wanted to ask you about a new book that's claiming the U.S. bombing of the Kabul offices, those are the offices of Al Jazeera in Afghanistan, was deliberate. In the 1% Doctrine, investigative journalist Ron Susskin writes, on November 13th, 2001, a hectic day when Kabul fell to the Northern Alliance and there were celebrations in the streets of the city, a U.S. missile obliterated Al Jazeera's office. Inside the CIA and White House, there was satisfaction that a message had been sent to Al Jazeera. In an interview with CNN, Susskind said government sources had told him there was great anger within the Bush administration over Al Jazeera's coverage of the invasion of Afghanistan. He added, "I'll tell you emphatically, it was deliberate act by the U.S." Your response, Dima Taboob, that was before, of course, the attack on the Al Jazeera offices. It was it happened earlier, 2 years earlier in Afghanistan.
I think these messages also were repeated on the same thing happened, in, you know, on the war in Iraq. A lot of threatening messages and, you know, messages of dismay on the coverage of Al Jazeera was, you know, broadcasted by American generals and British generals. So this dismay has been long, not just in, you know, the war in Afghanistan. It also appeared the same in Iraq.
Hamdi Rifai, where do you go with this case now?
Well, you asked previously about getting the memo. We don't even necessarily need to get the memo, but that's something that's going to come later. As the case progresses, if the government fails to respond to our notice of claim, we will then file a lawsuit and then be entitled to discovery. In that discovery, we can make demands for documents, obtain depositions, so we can actually bring people to the table with a court reporter, ask them questions, what was said, what happened, what occurred, etc. So even if we can't get disclosure of the memo, the American public is entitled to know what happened. Ms. Taboob is entitled to know what happened. And there will be a procedure where all this information comes out. Just as in any case, there's eventual accountability in every case.
Scores of journalists have died in Iraq. One of them is Jose Coso with Telecinco, Spanish television. His brother Javier and his mother have been on our broadcast a number of times. They, too, seeking justice for the death of Jose, who is in the Palestine Hotel, April 8, 2003, and just an hour or two after Tariq Ayub died in the Al Jazeera offices, the U.S. military shelled the Palestine Hotel and killed two journalists, one Jose Coso and the other Taras Prostyuk, a Ukrainian cameraman for Reuters. Is what Javier is doing any informing anything of what you are doing?
Well, we haven't consulted with them, so I can't really say exactly what they're doing. But obviously, at some point, their case is going to become very similar to ours, and our case will be very similar to theirs in the sense that we're pursuing the same thing, which is accountability and knowing what happened. And eventually, obviously, accountability for Ms. Taboob and the fact that she's been left a widow and her daughter, Fatima, has been left without a father.
We'll leave it there and we'll follow this case. Dima Taboob, I want to thank you for being with us, widow of Al Jazeera reporter Tariq Ayub. She is a professor at the University of Jordan. Hamdi Rifai, attorney for Dima Taboob. Thank you for joining us. Democracy
thank
Now!
You.
Is produced by Mike Berkshroof, Abdul Kadus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich and Aaron Mate, and Frank Lopez, Nick Marsilio, and Mike DeFilippo. Our engineers, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.